Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is a Webtoon Wednesday episode, and today I have the creator of a strip called Everywhere and Nowhere here to talk to me about that strip, as well as a couple of other strips he has on Webtoon. So I'd like to welcome Mary Weathery to the show. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, and if everybody detects a slight accent, you want to let everybody know where you're from?
I'm from Denmark, but my accent is kind of a mixture of Nordic and British.
Yeah, definitely. And I got a chance to meet Mary at LA Comic Con a couple of weeks ago, as you're listening to this. So it was a real pleasure to have him on the panel, and he's a very talented and passionate creator. So I can't wait to talk about Everywhere and Nowhere. But first, before we do that, as we often do here on Webtoon Wednesdays, we want to dive into your secret origin. So can you kind of give us your background? Did you grow up reading comics? Were they always part of your life? Did you come to them later? What's the story there?
Well, I always kind of enjoyed things like cartoons and stuff, but the Japanese style of comics I really enjoyed from a very young age, because they kind of treated their readers like, you know, like adults. They took it seriously, took the story seriously, which I enjoyed. I wanted to do novels originally, ended up doing comics instead, because it was easy to get people to actually read it if you have pictures alongside it. Always kind of wanted to do stories, kind of wanted to be creative. So I ended up trying to find artists to do it because I couldn't draw. And then I ended up making webcomics. But the reason why is because the only manga publisher in Denmark went bankrupt before I could actually do it.
So when you were thinking about making a career out of being a storyteller, did you go to school for that? Or did you start writing stories at a young age? What was kind of your evolution there?
Well, both, really. I went to film school, but I had always been kind of interested in making stories.
Got it. Yeah, they're kind of similar when you talk about comics and film, being that as opposed to novels, like you were mentioning, it's telling stories visually as well as through a narrative. So they do have, and obviously a lot different, but they do have some things in common as well.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, they're both, as you mentioned, they're both visual and visual storytelling. There's actually a large amount of similarities between making comics and making movies. You want to show the story, not tell it. Show, don't tell it, they say.
Yeah, exactly. And so you mentioned getting into web comics because the largest manga publisher in Denmark kind of went belly up. So when you were in those early years, were you trying to go the more traditional route of print? And talk to us a little bit about that, about how so many people trying to break in, and it really is getting your foot in the door, whether that be on a platform like Webtoon or somewhere else. So you went through a lot of those same challenges, right?
Well, when I started doing webcomics, it was actually before Webtoon ever really started allowing, well, at least before US Webtoon started doing Discover, which is what is Canvas now, which is where they just let anyone upload whatever they want. Well, not whatever they want, but, you know, whatever comic they want. Unfortunately, as I mentioned before, not even the largest manga publisher, the only manga publisher in Denmark went bankrupt. I was trying to go the traditional route, because back then, webcomics were kind of taking a weird turn in the West. When I started doing webcomics, it was, the Smacktubes and places like that was very popular but not even that popular, and I kind of want to go the traditional route. So I had this Swedish artist I was working with. We did a comic called The Steam Dragon Express, and it's not the new one that's on Webtoon. It's a very old version of it. The publisher went bankrupt, and the only thing I could really do was upload it on the internet, and kind of went the long grind with that until obviously Webtoon came along, and I put my comic on Webtoon as kind of a random thought, really. I hadn't really thought a lot about it. It's kind of wanted my comic up everywhere. And then one day I checked, and it magically had 20,000 subscribers. Obviously, it became my main platform after that.
Yeah, definitely. So we'll talk a little bit more about that Webtoon as a platform sort of at the end. But we want to dive into the story now. I want to know what Everywhere and Nowhere is about and talk a little bit about the characters. When I started reading it, I didn't have any idea, and I was pleasantly surprised to see some familiar characters. So why don't you tell everybody kind of what the story is about and the characters that inhabit this world that you've helped to create?
Everywhere and Nowhere is a story about a pair of Danish noblemen from the Middle Ages. Well, obviously, one female, one male. We changed it around a bit to give it a better dynamic. And they're kind of lost in time. Something happened, and we haven't really gotten into that in the webtoon yet. Something happened that caused them to become time travelers. Kind of lost in time, immortal, in fact. And they kind of go from place to place, meeting different historical characters, and there's some mysteries going on. They're kind of halfway being hunted by their evil future selves, who became bored after 100,000 years of seeing history repeating itself over and over, and became evil because of that. So yeah, that's what it's about.
Yeah, and you mentioned that these characters who are beloved, and they've appeared in other plays. People have taken these characters, put them in other plays. Kind of more comedic. They're pretty dark in Hamlet, but there's been some satire and some comedy plays with them in there. And you've kind of followed that same sort of idea of taking these characters that are a bit one-dimensional in Hamlet and kind of making them more than what they were originally. But I wonder what inspired you to choose something like this, to choose an inspiration, a couple of Shakespearean characters, and build on something pre-existing. And obviously, you mentioned you're from Denmark, and these are Danish characters, so that connection there is obvious. But beyond that, what was there that made you decide, let's take these two characters, let's even gender bend one of them, and let's turn it into a time travel story? It's so interesting that you kind of the choices you made early on. So I'm curious about your thought process there.
Well, it's a little bit of a niche pair of characters, really. I mean, Rosencrantz and Guildenstern aren't even in any sort of way main characters. Have like a few lines in the main play. Play kind of like these two bumbling idiots in some versions of the play. I don't know what exactly happened with these two characters. They became kind of these surreal background characters that a lot of people started playing around with. Well, not a lot of people, but they have this like little niche fan base, and they're used in a lot of different media. Some other stories. Have you ever watched Harold and Kumar?
Yes.
So in Harold and Kumar, there are these two characters called Rosenberg and Goldstein, and they're two Jewish gentlemen. And they kind of appear along the adventure that Harold and Kumar go on. They kind of appear randomly around them. And they're based on Rosencrantz and Guildenstern as well. So Rosencrantz and Guildenstern actually appear in a lot of different stories in a lot of different weird ways. And that kind of inspired me. It made me want to think like, what if they are like just lost in history? What if they're also the only two characters who didn't die on screen in Hamlet? They died off screen. We're just told they died. It's just brushed off. It's also the last line in the play. It's Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead. Mm-hmm. And another really great writer actually turned that into a film and a play. It's Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead. That's the title of it. And it is about them kind of stumbling through this like weird surreal world where everything is fiction and they're trying to make sense of it. Trying to just make sense of the world they're placed in, where everyone acts like theater characters. I don't know why it just kind of clicked. It's actually something I've been wanting to do for a long time. I made a manga, a black and white manga print, made for print story about them. They were kind of sociopathic in that one. I don't think that one would do so well on Webtoon, but I kind of like the new version of them. Yeah. The reason why Guildenstern is a girl, I don't know. I kind of feel like they could be a good couple. They're kind of around each other all the time. They could have made both of them men. Wouldn't really have been a huge difference, I think.
Yeah, you know, and I mentioned that the characters in the play you mentioned as well, much more dark, much more still bumbling, but it wasn't necessarily the comedic part of them there that you've kind of brought into your story, and some lightheartedness too. So And then you mentioned the other version where, black and white and they were, psychopathic. So you really have sort of taken them, this inspiration and decided to use them as characters. But they have evolved a lot, in the different ways that you've used them till you finally got to this, final version. So go through your process with, trying out and the, kind of the thought process with trying out these different versions until you, ended up with, the versions that we see in the successful strip on Webtoon now. Was it just a matter of kind of tinkering until you felt that you got it right? Or was it feedback from, other people that had read the story? How did they kind of evolve in your mind, in your process, in your stories to be, where they are now?
Well, in the very original version, which is the one shot that's not actually online anymore, which is the black and white one shot I made, they were, well, Dylan Cern, who is a very nice, very gentle character in the Webtoon version, was a very angry, bitter character in the old version. And Rosencrantz, who is a very nice, gentle, maybe a little insecure character in the Webtoon version, in the old version was in fact kind of a sly, manipulative character. And these traits did find themselves their way back in the future versions, in the Webtoon, spoiler warning, although it's all right, it doesn't really spoil a lot. These traits are in fact kind of parodied by the alternate future versions where Guildenstern is kind of mad with boredom and wants to kill people. And Rosencrantz is kind of a sly, manipulative guy. In fact, trying to manipulate his past self, where that's where things get a little weird with timelines. But yeah, I wanted to make them more appealing. I wanted to make them more bright, more characters you actually feel for and actually want to see happy. And I think we succeeded fairly well with that. I'm still kind of trying to grow the character of William. I still feel like he's not really reached his full potential. But we, with season two, we're giving him some upgrades. He's getting a new design and, we're going through some ideas for that, but I think it's going to be pretty exciting. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good point. It's much easier to relate to a character and root for a character that's likable as opposed to the other way around. So that's a good, that's a good point. You need to make sure that you at least put something, even for a villain, you at least put something in there that people can relate to. Otherwise, if they don't care about the characters, they're not going to care about the story.
That's true.
Now, you mentioned that, you changed the gender of one of the characters. She's female now, and there's a little bit of a spark of romance. I mean, they're clearly close friends, and you can see the possibility that maybe something could happen, but maybe not. Maybe it's more brother or sister. But it's certainly that relationship, the closeness of them, is something that plays throughout the first season. So, is that idea of closeness and exploring relationships, friendships, is that something as a writer that, you like to explore, you find interesting, you find there's a lot of story to mine in that, idea?
Well, a few of my friends and a few of the artists I work with have pointed this out before, that a lot of my biggest comics are actually about a guy and a girl doing something or going on an adventure. Maybe it's kind of a formula that really works for me. It's very simple, but just two characters going on some sort of wacky adventure, that's a big thing. It's in Winter Moon as well, which is my other feature comic. It's basically in, I think the only one that doesn't have that is Internet Explorer. That's just Internet Explorer being depressed. it's that's just the kind of the formula I like to work with. It's definitely a story about friendship, about friends trying to stick together. In season one, we played a lot about around with William kind of feeling he doesn't really deserve to just hang out with Anne, who hang out with Guildenstern, who is kind of a very powerful character when you really get down to it. She's very emotionally strong, and William really isn't when you actually think of it, because he's kind of plagued by this insecurity of not wanting to become the sociopathic manipulator that he's seen himself become in the future version. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because there's so many strong stories where you have, you know, just one protagonist and maybe a sidekick or, you know, somewhat of a lesser character. One of the things that really stood out to me in this story, Everywhere and Nowhere, is how much equal time each of the characters get. Like, it really is a story about two characters that are equally the main characters. There's not one that seems more important than the other. And so often when a writer is writing a story where it's just one protagonist or one main protagonist, there's so much of themselves in that protagonist. And that's kind of their touch point to the story. And we kind of get to learn about what the writer is or creator is interested in through that character. So now you have the two main characters here in your story, and you yourself have mentioned the differences between the two. So would you say they're each kind of different aspects of your personality, or is it more that you are exploring things that aren't, you know, maybe one of the characters is closer to your personality than the other?
I'd say William is who I am, and Anne is more like who I want to become.
Got it.
Like, my male characters, for example, Florence from Winter Moon or William from Everywhere and Nowhere, they might start out kind of how I want to be, and then they always end up circling around into becoming what I pretty much am. My own kind of struggles and insecurities do end up kind of showing in them. Just naturally happens, really. Which is all right. I mean, characters do need some flaws. You can't just write about perfect people all the time. I really like Anne Guildenstern. I think she's a very strong character, but she does have some insecurities. She just doesn't really show them. Definitely more of a mysterious character. We never really see her thoughts. We've never heard Guildenstern's thoughts, but we've heard William's. So I'd say William is a little bit more the main character than Anne, but basically I tried to keep it balanced between them.
Yeah, I think you've done that really well. We've mentioned that the time travel aspect, is that something as well that you wanted to explore? I mean, it does give you a lot of freedom to be able to go to different time periods, play with different settings, and even go back and change things later if you want. Time travel just inherently has that, you know, and we've seen their future selves. And so I'm just always curious when a writer decides to take on the challenge of time travel, because it does let you play with the story structure. So what was your what was kind of the impetus behind that, deciding to go with that complexity of a time travel story with these characters?
I really like a story called After School Charisma, which is about it's like Clone High. It's like Clone High, if you've seen that cartoon ever.
No, I have not. I'm not familiar with that.
Okay, well, it's basically about a school where they took DNA from pretty much all the famous historical characters in history and made them into a high school kid.
Wow, that's
amazing. So you see a lot of different guys like Mozart and basically anyone, Jeanne d'Arc, Nightingale, people like that. Einstein is also in it. And you see them kind of building connections with each other. And that really inspired me, the idea of having like famous characters from history being put into these situations, like just socializing like normal kids. So I kind of wanted to show some of that. With regards to time travel, there's this famous thing that the creators of Rick and Morty did, is they put time travel on the shelf in Rick's garage, which literally means they're not even going to touch time travel in any regard because of how much it complicates stories. And that's something I've struggled with a little bit as well. Time travel is really hard to write about because you end up just creating so many plot holes. I've tried my best to kind of limit that. They go to single locations. But I really want to I really want to include way more historical characters than I actually have. I've had Einstein, I've had Alcibiades, which is someone who most comic creators haven't really touched, which is pretty interesting. His story is pretty crazy. I definitely want to do more within season two soon. There's going to be way more focus on time travel. I got to try and limit their power because time travel is really way too strong of a power to have.
Yeah, well, isn't the other aspect of it, from at least from a reader's perspective, is that you also want to be sure that, like, when you read something, it matters in the story, right? Like, it has lasting effects, and you feel like you're not wasting your time. If you read, you know, 4 or 5 or 6 episodes, and then it all gets erased because of time travel, then you kind of feel cheated in a way. Like, well, why did I bother to read that if it was just going to get reset or what have you? It's a problem that the big comic print publishers have, right? Like Marvel and DC, they're constantly changing things, and then some fans get kind of left out in the cold saying, well, I've been reading this Batman book for the last 3 years, and now you're telling me none of it counts? Well, why did I bother?
Yeah, pretty much. It's what causes time travel to become this beast that's so hard to tackle in fiction. But what I really wanted to do with Everywhere and Nowhere is take them out of time. They have no real time to be in. They are they're floating around time. They're not constant like normal human beings. It's a little bit of a weird concept. It's like Schrodinger's cats. They're alive and not. They're both there and they aren't. They're everywhere and nowhere, like title suggests. What I really hope to do is basically the historical characters have already happened. Everything they have already been seen. So it's really just about these characters who are scrambled across time, trying to find their way to go back to being normal humans. That's the idea, which I haven't really touched a lot on, but I want to touch more on. And I hope that will kind of go to, they obviously can't reverse their own time, and they cannot really reverse the time of whatever, of their alternate selves. So even if they can reverse time, and if they can go back in history, and if they can change things and redo things, they can redo things that happen to themselves. So hopefully that'll make it more clear, a better conflict. Yeah.
Let's change gears a little bit here and talk about the visual look of the world. Did you know right away, as you were developing it, what you wanted it to look like? Or was it something when you found an artist that you wanted to work with, where you said, okay, here's the story, develop a style for the world? Or did you specifically look for an artist that kind of had the aesthetic you were going for in your mind when you were trying to find an artist?
What I usually do when I find artists is to, I try to look at what they're good at drawing and where their strengths lie. So with Peach, his strength definitely lied with more comedy, with more bright feelings, with various different funny, colorful characters interacting with each other in funny ways. So I tried to make a story around that. And as always, I tried to make it a little more ambitious. His previous story was set in a high school. Wanted to kind of move it away from that. We ended up doing a little bit of the high school setting in season one. But definitely wanted to take him a little bit out of that and maybe use his skills with funny character designs and character interactions in a more ambitious way by including these crazy historical characters. That's kind of the feeling we aimed for, and I feel like we caught that relatively well. I think we can do more with more historical characters in season two.
Yeah, I think that's one thing that a lot of aspiring comic writers struggle with, is finding the right artist. You know, a lot of times you've got to pay them. They need to pay their bills as well. So, what advice would you give to somebody who's looking for an artist for their story? You know, like how do you do it? Where should they be looking? And, you know, kind of go through the process of those out there. Because I know it's a question that comes up a lot. How do I find an artist? I have a story that I want to tell.
So what I did is I went through many ideas of how I could possibly end up. I have this joke I usually tell about how I wrote a note. I wrote like a basic message, and then I sent it to 500 people on DeviantArt. I'm not sure if that's how what you want to do, but there's some truth in that. Like, basically just keep asking. You'll eventually find someone who wants to do it. I'd say don't try too hard on one artist. Don't try too hard to convince people to do your project. If they feel open to do it, they'll more than likely say yes. Obviously pay the artist. They need, it's not just about, like, I hear a lot of new writers talking about how, and I even had some frustrations with this as well, about how they are just as much part of creating this and they are not paying themselves. Why should they pay the artist? But the fact that you can't escape is that the artist is going to end up possibly spending hundreds of hours illustrating this comic from the ground up, and you're going to be writing at the most 10 hours a month, really, depending on how long the episodes are. But usually it's best to start with short comics. So really pay them. I mean, I got a sales job, and I spent basically all of the money on getting artists. It ended up getting to the point where my mom thought I was getting scammed because I kept sending thousands of dollars to random Asian artists and I was getting like nothing back for years. But all of a sudden it just blew up and I got some money back, and then I spent all of that hiring even more and it never stopped. To reiterate, write to as many artists as you can. I'd say don't have a story in mind right away, actually. I think having some flexibility about the story you want to do is best. Try to aim for having a good idea from the beginning. Have something to pitch the artist. Don't be afraid to change the story based on the artist's style. It usually ends up working better if it's something they already know how to do.
Yeah. Again, it goes back to the collaborative nature, right? I mean, it's not just them visually storytelling, but, you know, some of the best collaborations between writer and artist, the artists oftentimes get involved in the plotting of the stories as well.
Yeah, pretty much. What I usually do is I tell the artist, just change whatever you want in the script. That's what I do these days. And there's a reason for that. The big issue with working with artists as opposed to drawing it yourself, or for artists who work with writers as opposed to writing it themselves, the big issue is that you're never quite going to get 100% symmetry. You can try. You can get close. You can get close to perfect symmetry, but you're never quite going to get there. So any step towards kind of uniting the two into a seamless creation is a good step. So obviously an artist who writes their own story can kind of image what they want to draw from the beginning. I know some artists who don't even have a script. They basically just draw it and then kind of change it as they go along and stuff. Obviously they have an idea, maybe they have an outline. The way I kind of combat that is just by telling the artists, or like, first of all, writing it based on their art style, and then telling the artist, hey, change whatever you want. You can get pretty close to what I call seamless symmetry between the writing and the artwork when you do something like that. Yeah.
There obviously has to be a lot of trust to get to that point. So does that happen right away, or like, how does it, when someone's starting out, like, how do you know when you can trust your artist? Because I know that, you know, there are those artists out there who may take advantage, or, you know, you won't ever get the pages back, or they're changing things without, you know, they're just telling the story they want to tell. And now all of a sudden all the power has swung the other way. So what are some good signs of a good collaboration where, you know, okay, we're starting to click, maybe I don't have to write scripts that are quite so tight. I can, you know, let them have a little bit of freedom because it's in service to the story. What are some things that a beginning writer should look for in knowing when they can kind of trust their artist more?
Well, I used to be very, very strict around, like I had a very specific idea, and I really wanted the artist to kind of create it in my specific idea, but that's really the wrong way to do it. In terms of how you know when to trust them, it really depends on the artist. It's very hard to answer that question. I'd say, I don't know, like I'd say just if they seem to enjoy the story as much as you enjoy it, if they seem, I have this really great artist called Poku. Now with Poku, I do a comic called Clinical Forest, and I can tell Poku really enjoys it. She'll add these little quirks in the background, and she'll have these own little like changes to the comic that seem very endearing. So I'd say if a bad sign would be if they kind of constantly try to change it in a way where it seems like they just fundamentally don't really enjoy the story as it is. In that case, I'd be like, do you have a chat with them? See, hey, it seems like you're not really enjoying the story. Maybe we should change it into something you do enjoy. Or perhaps say, maybe this isn't working out. That's fine too. I mean, you wouldn't want to waste your time. You wouldn't want to waste either of your time if the story is just not being enjoyed at all. It's not going to lead to a good comic. You can usually tell. I think, if an artist is genuinely enjoying it, that's a really good sign. If they don't seem to be, find another one. Yeah,
it seems like open communication is kind of required in all that. So, it's the one thing that I would say. I mean, I'm not a creator at all, but you can speak to whether you agree with me or not, Mary. But, when they kind of cut off the lines of communication, they kind of ghosting you, and it's like pulling teeth even to get, them to return an email. I think that's probably a sign, as opposed to great communication. They're always asking questions, whether they want to be sure to get they're getting the writer's vision down on paper, or whether they're reaching out to say, hey, what if we do this? What if we do that? I think that's kind of when you know that, hey, we've got a good thing going here. Would you agree with that?
Keeping an open communication is obviously very important. Obviously, you can't always spend too much time talking about everything all the time. Usually, artists also have to work on the actual comic.
Right.
If you can talk with them through like Discord and Twitter casually, if they seem excited about it, if they're posting about the comic on their own, that's a really good sign. If they just kind of ghost you, if they don't really seem interested in it, that's kind of a whole different thing. But that's not necessarily a bad sign either. Some artists are just like that. They prefer to post their own originals. That's not really what you're working on. They might not be the most talkative always, but I think you can tell if they continue to draw the comic for a long time. It's obviously because they're into it.
Yeah.
Artists can always take commissions. It's like a lot of people have this idea of like artists being these starving individuals, and obviously artists aren't always getting paid the best wages, but in terms of work, the good artists who have a few thousand followers, even they can usually fill up their commissions pretty quickly. So if they're choosing to work on your comic rather than just do illustrations, that's already in and of itself a really good sign.
Yeah, that's a good point. Well, I want to talk a little bit about the Webtoon platform specifically. But before we do that, you have mentioned a few of your other strips that you have going on Webtoon. So can you give us a quick rundown of the other strips you have on Webtoon, and then we'll dive into talking about the platform itself?
Sure. I'll try to remember all of them. I've got Winter Moon, Everywhere and Nowhere. Those are my two original series with Webtoon. That means they're published by Webtoon. Then I've got Internet Explorer, Stalker X Stalker, Clinic of Horrors, a comic called Mean Girls, which is mostly just my random Twitter comics. And then I've got another one called Crawling Dreams. And then I have one called 1 Million Gold. And then I've got a few in development, one about an orc and an elf living in New York. And the elf is really into human culture. That's a whole other thing. But yeah, that's a kind of a brief rundown of my series.
Now, how many hours a week do you spend writing? Obviously, you're very prolific and have a lot of ideas that you want to share.
It's less about how many hours a week, and it's more like about how many hours a month. It's a little bit of a hard question because usually I don't really count the amount of hours. Sometimes I'm a little chaotic with my writing. Like right now, I'm actually in my hotel room right now. After this, I'm actually going to head to a PC cafe and write, because literally every single one of my series just ran out of scripts. I've been very focused on LA Comic Con and preparing for my trip over here. Yeah, so I've got a few artists sitting and waiting for more to draw. They're on my messenger right now. I'd say about 20 hours a month I spend on the actual writing itself. Now, obviously, I go around thinking about my stories all the time. Yeah. Usually, I write them in a large box so that they'll run on their own for a month or two before I have to write more.
Yeah, I was going to say, in your head, you're always, you know, that's just a writer's life, right? Like in your head, you're always working on the stories. It may not be that you're sitting down, you know, physically creating words, but you're always kind of working when you're a writer, even when you're just living your life, being inspired, going to LA Comic Con and meeting other creators and meeting fans and being inspired by the other work and that you see, you know, it's all fodder for the writing mill, right?
Yeah, pretty much. You're always thinking about ideas for your series. You always, whenever you see something, you're kind of like, how would that fit in my series? Right now I'm in LA. It's pretty cool. There's palm trees everywhere. It kind of looks like a Hollywood movie. Obviously trying to see if I can fit that in. Consider having Rosencrantz and Guildenstern walking down Hollywood Boulevard would be pretty funny. But it's not always that it makes it in, but it's kind of funny to think about.
All right. Well, let's talk about the platform itself. What are your overall feelings about Webtoon as a platform? You know, obviously you mentioned finding it way back in the day and your story's kind of blowing up there. So you must have some pretty good feedback for those that are considering using Webtoon as their publishing platform.
I'd say Webtoon is probably the best the best webcomic platform in the world right now. That's my honest opinion. I've been on a few. I was obviously on a lot of the older ones like SmackJeeves and Webtoon has been my single most positive experience with a webcomic platform. They're very nice. They're very engaged. Even the Canvas, which is the part where it's free to upload, they even started. They have a team now that have social media of their own. I hear they do even respond to DMs, which is pretty cool. Used to be mainly focused on the originals, but it's nice to see that the Canvas part of the site even has a small team. I started out on Webtoon in, I believe, possibly it was 2016 or so. Yeah, about 2016. Just kind of put my comic up as a back as a random thought, and it blew up. Yeah, and since then I've just kind of been focused on Webtoon primarily.
Now you mentioned you have some of your strips on the Canvas side where anyone can go and upload, and then we have the original or the featured side where Webtoon's paying the creators to publish on that side. They each offer kind of some positives that are sort of unique to that side, like, you know. The positives and the things that you have on the Canvas side aren't necessarily the benefits that you get on the original or featured side. So being that you have strips on both, I think it'd be a good one to ask. What are those unique benefits and how are they different in your mind for a creator, someone on the Canvas side versus doing the originals?
I really like that question, by the way. That's a good question. So Canvas is different in the way that you can pretty much upload whatever you want. I mean, there's obviously some guidelines, but you can any crazy niche weird idea that you're not really sure if anyone's going to enjoy, you can kind of do it if you feel strongly enough about it to actually either get it drawn or draw it yourself. You can do whatever you want on Canvas as I said, some guidelines, but that's the thing. Whereas on Webtoon originals, you kind of have to send it in. You have to see either that or get it really popular on Canvas. They do pick most of their original comics from Canvas. But that's the beauty of it. Really, it's independent publishing at its finest, and there's a ton of readers. So if you do something and it's and it's good, if you do something and it's good and you keep updating it, it's bound to get several thousand readers within the first few months, very easily, really. That's at least, I've tested it out a few times, actually. Sort of upload a comic and not advertise it at all through any of my other comics or any of my social media and see how big it gets. And it on its own, it gets a few thousand followers pretty easily if you kind of got the art down. Obviously, it needs some good artwork to catch some attention. But yeah, whereas the features part of this, also you can make your own schedule on the other one. You're not really screwing anyone over by taking breaks a little often and having a little bit of a flexible upload schedule. Although consistent uploading on specific days is actually the best way to do it. Whereas on the originals part of the site, where it's obviously published by Webtoon, there's some totally different perks. I mean, they obviously have some funds for you. You get some funds for your series to do it, to kind of focus your time on that. Meaning you don't really have to do other work. You can focus your work entirely on your Webtoon. And, the consistent schedule and the help from the editorial team helps you do a lot of, updates. I've seen this, like, no matter how much you try to keep a schedule on Canvas, it can get a little hard. It's a little tempting to just sort of, because no one other than the readers obviously are counting on you to get things done at that time. And even the readers are kind of understanding. They don't always expect to get new episodes all the time. But on originals, you have a strict schedule you got to keep. So, you end up having this more consistent updates, which is really nice. That's the primary good and bad side of both. Yeah.
Yeah, but we want to mention, though, it is totally possible to monetize the Canvas site as well. Just because Webtoon's not publishing it and paying you a page rate, they do offer ways to still get some compensation for your time, right?
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, they have Patreon integration, which allows you to advertise your Patreon pretty easily. They have some they have something called a bonus. I'm not really sure. They do offer you a bonus for publishing on Canvas, although they're trying to phase that out, I hear. And they have ad revenue. Now, ad sharing is really, really good. They helps you kind of earn money off the popularity of your series. So yeah, there's a bunch of ways to make money even on Canvas. Canvas is actually pretty good. It's a very nice platform with a lot of options for you.
Yeah, and another thing that they have in common, both original and Canvas, you know, they're both on the same website, which gets millions of visitors a month. So it is as Mary was saying, it is a great place, probably the best place to be publishing digitally right now, because anybody can do it. So that kind of leads us into talking about the fan community, and how do you feel about the fan community on Webtoon? Have you found it to be a pretty strong and positive community?
Yes, absolutely. You have some faces you see more now and again, and but people in the comments are really nice. Sometimes there's a little negative comment, but they usually get downvoted a lot. So I've had nothing but positive experiences with the Webtoon fan community. Sometimes they focus on a flaw, something you missed, or something a little bit too heavily, and that can get a little annoying. But you know that's how it is with most things. They mean well.
I wanted to specifically
definitely on the thing. Yeah,
go ahead. I was going to say I wanted to ask you specifically about your fan base, your reader base for Everywhere and Nowhere. What have you found that in season one that readership enjoyed the most? What did they respond to the most? Was there a particular part of the story or certain episodes that you were like, man, I really nailed it. Everybody seemed to love those.
The character drama with Rosencrantz and Guildenstern is something I personally really enjoy. And I think a lot of people really like that. The episodes focused around Guildenstern have had a really good reception. When she shows her strong side out of nowhere, it's always pretty fun. Even here during LA Comic Con, I had some keychains I had a keychain with Everywhere and Nowhere and a key and two keychains with Winter Moon. And I actually, despite Winter Moon being a bit more popular than Everywhere and Nowhere, I actually ran out of Everywhere and Nowhere keychains really fast. I think the two characters of Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are pretty well liked by the community, which I'm very grateful for. They're some of my favorite characters to do.
Yeah, you mentioned earlier about, was it Everywhere and Nowhere that you didn't pay that much attention to the readership, and then when you checked it was 20,000? Did that happen relatively quickly?
No, that was it's a really old webcomic. it was an old webcomic called The Crawling City from 2016. Everyone know it came way later.
So yeah. What was the reaction like with that? Did that hit right away, or was that more of a slow build?
I think it was a little bit of a slow build at the beginning, but we actually remade the entire comic when it got featured. It was originally like 4 panels an episode. Mm. When it got featured, when it became an original, that's how it used to be called featured, now it's original. Right. When it became an original series, we remade everything because we wanted it to have longer episodes. We wanted it to have more of a defined linear story that people could follow with a few villains here and there. And I think we did a pretty decent job at that. Obviously, had a few stumbles here and there, but I think with season 2 we're going to return really strongly. I have really studied a lot by watching a lot of different things, how to do time travel and how to present villains in a story. So I think season 2 is going to come back really strongly.
Now, do you have a release date for season 2 yet? Do you know when it's coming back?
Right now we are working on that. We had a release date, but we're pushing that a little bit because we really want to make sure that the episodes, we're really taking our time on these, the first few episodes of season 2. We really want to get it right because we gave both of the characters an upgrade. We kind of redefined the story, a bit to make it run more smoothly, to make it a little bit more engaging, to make the characters appear a little more time travel-y, I'd say. Looking at them in season 1, there's really nothing about their appearance that said they'd be a time traveler. I think season 2 is going to improve that a lot.
Cool. We look forward to that. Well, let's finish up here. You know, we've both mentioned LA Comic Con. You recently got to attend. So give us your overall con report. How was it to interact with the fans and your fellow webtoon creators? How did you find the show for yourself overall?
I think it was wonderful. I think it was amazing. In Denmark, the conventions are not very big at all. Usually held in small kind of sports halls, sometimes even at a school. So going to Los Angeles Comic Con was obviously extremely big. Now, I have been to conventions in Tokyo and stuff, which are also very big. But it was my first time actually attending as a guest, if you could say that, at a massive convention like that. So yeah, I think the best part was probably meeting just everyone at Webtoon, meeting the staff, meeting the other creators. Meeting the fans who came and got signatures. That was really cool. I got actually a fan art, which had every character from every single one of my ongoing series. It was like 9 or 10 characters. It was pretty crazy. I got that fan art. I'm going to frame it and put it up on my wall back at home. So yeah, LA was really good.
That's awesome. That's really great. Yeah. And it was great for me too. You know, I hadn't met a lot of the creators that I've had on Webtoon Wednesday. I hadn't ever met them in person too. So I kind of had the same sort of experience you did in putting, faces to voices and such. So that was great. I want to thank you, Meriwether Reed, for your time. It was great to meet you at LA Comic Con. Great for you to come on and talk to us about Everywhere and Nowhere, and give a lot of good advice about finding an artist and about the Webtoon platform as a whole. So as we wind up here, let me give you the floor. It's yours for a moment. You want to say anything to your readers or fans or the listeners maybe who haven't had a chance to check out your work? What would you want to say to them?
Coming to LA Comic Con has been very inspiring. I've met a lot of different creators. I've met a lot of the staff. I saw the Webtoon office building. It inspired me. It made me really want to get back into writing. And as we're closing down here, I'm actually gonna head over to a PC cafe, like I mentioned earlier. I'm gonna start writing. I have 6 scripts to make, so I'm hoping to entertain all the readers a lot. And thank you for inviting me. It was really fun. And thanks for doing a good panel at LA Comic Con. It was very interesting meeting you.
Yeah, it was a great panel. We could have gone for another hour. I would tell everybody, was it long enough? We had a giant line of people still ready to ask questions. So that was great. Well, as we wind up here, Mary, so people will know when season 2 of Everywhere and Nowhere is coming out, or just to interact with you on social media, ask questions, what have you. Where's the best place online to follow along with you, to follow your work, to reach out if anyone has questions and such?
I'm on Instagram, maryweather.comics, and I'm also on Twitter at maryweather, and then an E and a Y at the end of it. Next season of Everywhere and Nowhere is probably going to be out next month.
All right, everybody. Well, thanks for joining us. Thanks for listening to another Webtoon Wednesday. And thanks to Mary for joining me. And we'll talk to you all next time.
Thanks for having me.
You can find the Comic Source Podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whichever podcasting app you prefer. Please tell all your friends about us, subscribe, and rate us. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, be sure to visit us at lrmonline.com to join the conversation, access the show notes, and discover all our other great pop culture content. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All 3 spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.